It's Debbie back on Wednesday, July 27th, 2016, with part two of the Decatur Herald and Review read from the computer page for their e-edition, starting with the death notices, as we normally do. Decatur, Cloyd, Stella A. Stella A. Holway Cloyd, 96, of Eureka, Missouri, formerly of Decatur, died peacefully on Memorial Day, May 30th, 2016, at St. Andrews, assisted living, surrounded by members of her family. Visitation with the family will be on Friday, July 29th, 10 a.m. at St. Thomas Catholic Church, followed by Mass at 11 a.m., and a private burial in Graceland Cemetery. Decatur. Davis, Mary E. Mary E. Davis, 99, of Sullivan, formerly of Decatur, was called home by our loving father Saturday, July 23rd, 2016, at Mason Point in Sullivan. Services to celebrate Mary's life will be 1 p.m. Wednesday. They were this afternoon, 1 p.m. Wednesday at Graceland Fairlawn Funeral Home, with visitation being prior to the services and the burial at Boiling Springs Cemetery. The family is being served by the Graceland Fairlawn Funeral Home. Decatur, Mowry, Doris Ann. Doris Ann Mowry, 86, of Jacksonville, passed away Sunday, July 17, 2016, at Jacksonville Skilled Nursing. Graveside services to celebrate the life of Doris Mowry will be 11 a.m. Saturday, July 30th, 2016, at Graceland Cemetery. Visitation will be from 10 a.m. to 10:45 Saturday at Graceland Fairlawn Funeral Home. Memorials may be directed to Alzheimer's Association. Harristown, Lee, Coven Allen. Coven Allen Lee, 81, of Harristown, Illinois, passed away at 5:50 a.m. Tuesday, July 26, 2016, in Decatur Rehabilitation Center. A service to celebrate his life will be held at 10:30 a.m. Friday, July 29th, at Dawson and Wyckoff Westwood Street Funeral Home. Burial will be in Macon County Memorial Park Cemetery, Harristown, with military honors provided by the Macon County Honor Guard. The family will receive friends for a time of visitation beginning at 9:30 a.m. Friday morning until service time at the funeral home. Memorials may be made to the family. Decatur, Turley, Juanita M. Juanita M. Turley, 61, of Decatur, went home to be with God at 1:30 a.m. Friday, July 22nd, at St. Mary's Hospital. Funeral services will be at 1 p.m. Thursday, July 28th, in Summit Avenue Baptist Church. Visitation will be at 1 hour. Will be 1 hour before services in the church. Burial will follow in Boiling Springs Cemetery. Tanzius Logan Funeral Services is in charge of the arrangements. Champaign, Chrisman Carol J. Carol J. Chrisman, age 79, of Champaign, died at 1:53 p.m. Friday, July 22, 2016, at Carl Hospital in Urbana. Her funeral service will be at 11 a.m. Friday, July 29th, at the Bible Baptist Church in Champaign, with Pastor Mark Smith officiating. Burial will be in Drummer Township Cemetery in Gibson City at 3 p.m. Visitation will be from 5 to 8 p.m. Thursday, July 28th, at Lamb Funeral Home in Gibson City. Monticello, Foster, E. Clyde. E. Clyde Foster, 86, of Monticello, passed away at 5 p.m. Sunday, July 24th, 2016, at Carl Hospital, Urbana. Visitation will be held from 4 to 8 p.m. Thursday, July 28th, at the Mackey Wright Funeral Home. Funeral services will be held at 11 a.m. Friday, July 29th, at First Christian Church in Monticello, with Reverend Danny Roberts officiating. Interment will be held in Monticello Township Cemetery. Memorial donations may be made to the DeLand Christian Church. Weldon, Dorothy Jean Tribbett. Dorothy Jean Tribbett, 78, of East Moline, Illinois, passed away July 24, 2016, at her home. Memorial service will be at 10 a.m. on Thursday, July 28th, at St. John's Lutheran Church, East Moline, Illinois. Reverend Kent Umberger will officiate. That is the end of the obituaries for Wednesday, the 27th of July, as printed in the e-edition of the Herald and Review. Continuing on in the D section. Blueberries add big flavor to baby Dutch babies. This is by Kim Ode of the Tribune News Service. When we barely had our coffee, we can't take too much drama, but we still want a great breakfast. We love those puff pancakes, whether you call them Dutch babies or German puffs or pannekoeken or those really good things that collapse. They swell solely on the power of eggs and high heat and usually are made in a large cast iron skillet emerging from the oven, fantastically puffy before deflating to a more pancake-like appearance. The sight always offers delighting if fleeting drama, but also a wish that the ratio of eggy interior to crisp outer shell could be improved. Turns it out it can be by making individual puffs in muffin tins. Call them baby Dutch babies. We use 2 muffin tins to make a dozen puffs, placing the batter in every other cup to make room for the puffiest puffs possible. But they also can be made in one pan. They would just be a little crowded. The batter comes together in a minute, but greatly benefits from a 10-minute rest before baking. You can use that time to make a super easy blueberry compote. In the 20 minutes the puffs are in the oven, you can put the finishing touches on your meal, then assemble your brunch guests or your fortunate family for the grand reveal. The lofty puffs that you pull from the oven will begin to deflate almost at once, which is the whole idea. Blueberries are at their peak right now, but if you're more of savory persuasion, experiment with other fillings. A Denver-style mix of finely diced and sautéed ham, onions, and peppers would be delicious. Just nix the cinnamon in the recipe, or maybe a southern sausage and gravy filling would fill that bill. Whatever you choose for your morning meal, you'll be ready for whatever drama the day yet holds. End of that recipe for now. Article on this page. New kidneys, 4 years apart, show transplant progress and hurdles. This is by Lauren Neergaard, Associated Press writer. Washington. Brenda Hudson recalls weeks spent in a glass-enclosed isolation room after her first kidney transplant, her family allowed to visit only when suited up against germs. That transplant lasted a remarkable 4 decades. And now, Hudson's recovery from a second one, this time faster and surrounded by germy visitors, showcases how far organ transplants have come and the hurdles that still await. "I'm ready to be well again," Hudson exclaimed before being wheeled into an operating room at MedStar Georgetown University Hospital last month, far more confident than back at age 17 when she was at that hospital's first recipient for a living donor kidney. Transplants still require courage, but medical advances haven't just helped patients. Hudson's initial donor, her older sister, has a scar stretching from belly to side where doctors cut into her rib cage. This time, Hudson's husband donated and went home 2 days after surgeons squeezed his kidney through a roughly 3-inch incision. Hudson's own lupus-damaged kidneys were removed about a month before her first transplant. That's hardly ever done anymore. Non-working kidneys shrink to make room. Back then, finding a donor was pretty miraculous. It still is. And with more than 120,000 people on the national waiting list for a kidney or other donated organ, but only about 30,000 transplants performed each year, new moves are getting underway to try to ease the critical shortage. Efforts range from smartphone apps letting would-be donors register with a few clicks to helping transplant centers use some organs that today would be discarded for fear they're not good enough. "I really didn't think about getting another kidney. How could I be that fortunate?" said Hudson, 57, of Owings, Maryland, who this time went home 5 days after surgery. Her thoughts strayed to friends on dialysis. "I only wish we could see more donors coming out." The average kidney from a deceased donor lasts 10 years, while one from a living donor averages about 15, said Dr. David Clayson of UNOS, UNOS, the United Network for Organ Sharing. UNOS, which oversees the nation's transplant system. Doctors can't explain why occasionally people like Hudson beat those odds by a lot. Dana Hudson knew his wife wouldn't ask for another kidney, so when her first deteriorated badly enough to require dialysis, he volunteered. Dr. Matthew Cooper, Georgetown's kidney and pancreas transplant director, examined the fifth side organ and proclaimed, "It's a beauty." Sewing it into its new owner, however, would prove nerve-wracking. Dana Hudson underwent a battery of tests to make sure he was healthy enough to live with one kidney. The keyhole surgery used for living donation today is easier on patients, but trickier for surgeons. Guided by a miniature camera, Dr. Syed Ghazmian inserted long-handled probes through tiny abdominal incisions and painstakingly snipped the kidney free from surrounding tissue. It was producing plenty of urine and had great blood vessels, Ghazmian reported, but he paused before severing that blood supply, the point of no return. Across the hall, Cooper had found a problem with Brenda Hudson. Hunched tensely over the operating table, Cooper was uncovering arteries hardened by high blood pressure and type 2 diabetes, no good for sewing on her husband's kidney. Finally, the surgeons devised a way for blood vessels to feed the incoming organ. This was not an easy case, Cooper said. You have to have a plan B. Back across the hall again, Ghazmian made the final cut to Dana Hudson's kidney and tugged it through a slit in the abdomen. Taking the kidney, Cooper flushed out the donor's blood, cleaned away some yellowish fat, and carefully carried it to Brenda Hudson with one brief stop. Using high-tech imaging, researchers scanned the kidney's filtering tubules as part of a study to better determine which donated organs will have the best outcome. Soon after being stitched into place, Brenda Hudson's new kidney started to work. 2 days later, she softly told her husband, "It's pretty amazing what you did for me, honey." End of that. In a little boxed piece right under that article is more information in this area. Boosting supply. Apple says its upcoming software update will let iPhone users register as an organ donor through its health app, linking to Donate Life America's national registry. Georgetown also is developing an app for smartphones and tablets that will allow a click for donor registration. Next, studies are underway to preserve donate organs longer by pumping them with oxygenated fluids and to spur use of a higher-risk organs that work despite not being in optimal condition, Klessen said. And then thirdly, the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center and Donate Life launched a new Facebook page to educate the public about the need for living donors. Fewer than 6,000 every year give a kidney or part of their liver. End of that topic. The next article, and it's another healthcare one, aorta root rupture is aneurysm very close to the heart. And it's answers from a Dear Dr. Roach. Aortic root rupture is aneurysm very close to the heart. Dr. Keith Roach for the Herald and Review. Dear Dr. Roach, 2 weeks ago, my sister-in-law, age 74 and in excellent health, collapsed and died suddenly and unexpectedly while working full-time at a nearby university. The autopsy reports that she died from aortic root rupture. My brother and all of us need to more fully understand these words. What causes aortic root rupture? What are its symptoms? Does stress play a significant part in this kind of death? Is this genetic? My brother is struggling terribly with his wife's death, as are all the family. Any help you can give us will be deeply appreciated. Answer. I am sorry to hear about your sister-in-law. The aortic root is the beginning of the aorta, the largest blood vessel in the body. The root is right where it begins at the aortic valve where blood comes out of the left ventricle. A rupture at this point almost always means an aneurysm, an enlargement of the blood vessel. As the blood vessel expands, it thins. The pressure against the wall of the vessel increases, further increasing the risk of rupture. The most common risk factors for aortic root aneurysm are smoking, high blood pressure, diabetes, and high cholesterol. However, even with multiple risk factors, this is a rare condition, seen in about one person in 10,000. It's much more likely in men than in women. Stress may increase blood pressure and can predispose people to bad habits, but it is not the direct risk for aortic aneurysm or rupture. Marfan syndrome is a genetic condition characteristically associated with aneurysms of the aortic root. People with Marfan syndrome, which is caused by an abnormal gene for the structural protein fibrillin, are often taller than their parents with disproportionately long arms and certain other characteristics of their chest, eyes, and hard palate. Even so, some people are never diagnosed, partly because of the range of expression of the condition is broad. Most authorities recommend that first-degree family members, siblings, children, of people people who have had a dilatation or aneurysm of the thoracic aorta get evaluated by a screening test. I would recommend that your sister-in-law's immediate family discuss this with their physician. More information is available at www.marfan.org. End of that. Continuing with the body stuff, hamartoma, M-A-M-A-R-T-O-M-A. Dear Dr. Roach, I had a CT scan of my heart, which also revealed a spot in my left lung. A pulmonology diagnosed it as a hamartoma, 2 centimeters in length. When they looked at a scan from 16 years earlier, they found that it was there in 1.4 centimeters in length. My doctor is not concerned since it's only grown 6.6 centimeters in 16 years. What can you tell me about a hamartoma? Is there anything I can do to shrink or eliminate it? Answer. A hamartoma, from the Greek root meaning defect, is a benign type of tumor, the most common benign tumor of the lung. It is a disorganized group of cells that grow very slowly and have no or almost no potential to become a malignant cancer. Hamartomas are most common in men between 50 and 70. They're usually diagnosed incidentally, meaning they're discovered when looking for something else, as in your case. Mistakes in diagnosis are very rare by an experienced reader of a CT scan. Nothing usually needs to be done for a hamartoma, especially one like yours, that has been very stable over a long time. Although it could be removed surgically, there's no reason to take that risk, except in the rare case where a very large hamartoma is pushing up against something important, like a major blood vessel. That's the end of Dr. Roach for today. And the last article on this page, Miss Cleo Actress Dies. This is from AP out of Fort Lauderdale, Florida. The actress who became famous playing the Jamaican psychic Miss Cleo, claiming to know callers' futures in ubiquitous TV infomercials and commercials 15 years ago, has died of cancer. Uri Del Harris, 53, died Tuesday in Palm Beach, her lawyer William J. Cohn Jr. said. The Los Angeles-born Harris was a struggling actress when the Psychic Readers Network hired her in the late 1990s to play Miss Cleo. She adopted her family's Jamaican heritage for the role, persuading viewers to call for allegedly free psychic readings. In one commercial, she's seen poring over tarot cards before telling a caller that her father of her baby is the one who was very unpleasant and had another girlfriend while he was sleeping with you, but you knew that. The commercials end with the tagline, "Call me now." The federal government said these free calls cost consumers about $1 billion. The Federal Trade Commission said the psychic service promised a new free reading, but consumers calling a toll-free number were directed to a 900 number charging $4.99 per minute. The agency said nearly 6 million people made such calls and were charged an average about $60 apiece. The Psychic Readers Network parent company forgave $500 million in customer charges in a 2002 settlement. After the settlement, Harris mostly faded from view for over a decade. End of that article. We'll switch briefly to the Decatur Tribune Online Paul Osborne editor to read Paul Osborne's City Beat. Potential candidates should give a lot of thought before running for city council. Several years ago, says he, during the latter part of my first term as mayor, I had to stop by a store to have a repair made on a small piece of equipment. There were two people at the counter I approached. One was a guy who appeared to be making sure the chair he was sitting in didn't escape because he was holding it down and made no attempt to get out of it and asked what I needed. The other person was a young woman who appeared to be doing all the work. She was polite, and a few minutes into our conversation, about why I was there, she asked, "You're the mayor, aren't you?" I nodded in an affirmative way, and the guy leaning back in the chair straightened up and said, "You're the mayor?" I said I was. Then he said something that was classic. "You know, I've been thinking of running for mayor. How much does it pay?" He continued with how much fun he thought it would be to have the mayor's job and painted a fairly rosy picture of a life of power and privilege by being mayor. "I follow city politics, and it would be really cool to be part of it," he said, and again asked, "How much does it pay?" He seemed shocked when I told him it paid $8,000 a year, which is far below the poverty line. Anyone who anticipates running for a mayor or city council should realize they won't get rich serving in local offices. A city council member receives $4,000 a year. I can't speak for anyone else who has served as mayor or city council, but I lost far more money than I ever made as mayor. This newspaper could no longer print city legals during the years I served in office, which was a considerable sum. When you become mayor or city council member, it will have an impact on your job, the time you can spend with your family or recreation, plus the moment you take the oath of office, you suddenly become brain dead in the eyes of many people who disagree with you or your votes. Smile. Someone once said that anyone who aspires to run for public office should be disqualified on the basis of bad judgment for deciding to run in the first place. I was almost tempted to impart that to the young man who asked me about running for mayor when he asked for some words of wisdom. Like, if you're mayor, you'll have to get out of that chair or do something. Or, I find it strange that someone who's so involved in city politics doesn't even know who the mayor is when he's standing in front of you. Maybe I looked younger in person. I certainly encourage people who have a desire to run for city council or other local bodies to do their homework before getting involved and be able to explain why they would like to be, why they'd be a good choice for council member or mayor. Well, the years I spent as mayor were extremely busy because I was also running this newspaper at the same time and stressful. I would not change the experience for anything and was never sorry that I ran for election and re-election and was able to serve. I've always been proud of this community and thought about the decision to run for several years. It was a rich and rewarding time. A rich and rewarding experience in many ways, not so rewarding in a few ways, and there is no doubt I became a better editor and person by working to help the community I love. I was honored to be the leader of the city, and I'm still happy to be continuing the fight as a private citizen and newspaper editor to move the city forward and support those with the same mindset. My advice, based on personal experience, is if you are considering running for mayor or city council member, and it's not because you're mad at something the city has done, talk to people you respect and get their input on your ideas and if they'll support you if you run. Most of the successful candidates I know followed that formula. If you are someone who just wants to complain about everything, please don't run for office. You're doing a great job where you are at home, and it doesn't take any energy on your part. He continues. Three candidates have officially entered city council race, is the small headline within this part. There's presently three candidates who have officially made it known they are going to run for the Decatur City Council in next April's election. Park Board Commissioner Chris Riley was the first to announce, and I wrote about his decision in an earlier edition. Chuck Kuhl and present Councilman Patrick McDaniel announced their candidacies late last week. Stories about Kuhl and McDaniel's official announcements are in the column at left. I don't know if we can find that or not. 3 4-year terms on the council will be up for election, and this will be a very important selection of candidates because of the challenges that are facing our city. The common thread that's evident in all three candidates who are asking voters to elect or re-elect, in McDaniel's case, them, is that all have served in public office before seeking election to the council. Riley has served many years on the Decatur Park Board. Kuhl served many years on the Macon County Board, and McDaniel continues to serve on the City Council. Seeking election is not something they decided to do because they got ticked off over an issue and decided to do something about it by getting elected to office. I've known the first three candidates for a long time, and I know they've given a lot of thought to making this move toward more public service. I've talked with each of them along with others they have contacted before they move forward their decision to serve or continue to serve in public office. Although many others may announce for the city council seats before the filing of nomination petitions take place toward the end of the year, the first three out of the chute have experience, which is reassuring in a day when few people want to move into public service arena because of time and energy commitments. End of that piece by Paul Arisborn. Another thing from the Decatur Tribune, City Council holds gaming study session. That was July 18th. The community was provided with an opportunity to express thoughts on video gaming in Decatur Monday night, July 18th, during an open study session held to gather public input on the subject. A mix of residents, gaming establishment, and bar owners and other business proprietors that host gaming machines addressed council during the study session. A total of 8 members of the public spoke, with much of the public and council sentiment being to look for ways to limit the number of gaming parlors going that focus primarily on gaming with limited food, drink, or other activities going forward. In the coming weeks, staff will prepare a list of options for council consideration related to the issue and present staff costs for processing licenses as the cost of licensing is considered. In other business, council members approved a series of annexations for properties with current water service agreements and voted to allow alcohol consumption for the Decatur celebration this year until 11 p.m. on Friday and Saturday. Celebration officials had requested an extension until midnight, but decided to rescind that request until next year to allow time to consider the potential cost of also sharing in the added city expense for the added hour of operation. The end of that, and the end of what we will read out of the Decatur Tribune. In national news, back in the Decatur Herald and Review here, and still in the A section, NYPD B squad ready to handle urban swarms. New York, AP. Daniel Higgins is one cop who knows a thing or two about sting operations. Although the New York Police Department detective's main job is working in a counterterrorism unit, he is also one of the 2 official department beekeepers who don protective gear and head to the scene when buzzing swarms of the insects glom onto buildings, street lights, or other pieces of the urban landscape. The NYPD Bee Brigade responds to dozens of calls each spring and summer, including some recently where officers use vacuums to remove grotesque, wiggling masses of tens of thousands of bees from a lamppost near Grand Central Terminal, the awning of a restaurant, or even chained bicycle near Times Square. Last month, the 9/11 alert that appeared on their handheld electronic device read, "Investigate possible crime, vicious animal." That led to a swarm that had attached itself to a brick wall in Brooklyn. You try to get there as quickly as you can to corral them because you don't want the bees to fall on the public. Even a wind gust can knock them down, Higgins said. About 20,000 bees were once plucked from a Park Avenue bush. As unlikely as it may seem in a city considered a concrete jungle, New York has plenty of bees, drawn to greenery that produces pollen, including flowers, plants, trees, even landscaped rooftops. Since 2010, when the city legalized beekeeping, the New York honeybee population has soared from just a few dozen illegal hives. Most of the buzzing inhabitants live in about 300 government-registered hives and gardens, backyards, and rooftops, including an elegant Waldorf Astoria hotel terrace, according to the city's health department. Hundreds more thrive in surrounding suburbs. City officials welcome the bees, except when hives become overcrowded and about half the bees leave to form swarms that last a few days while an egg-laying queen and her scouts search for a new home. To startled city residents, the phenomenon can have a horror film quality. They come in with a loud buzz like a school of fish, and then they cluster up, Higgins said. Wearing a protective suit, gloves, and a meshed veil, Higgins and fellow NYPD beekeeper Officer Darren Mays suck up the huddled creatures with the vacuum linked to plastic buckets. "We don't kill the honeybees. We don't spray them. We don't destroy them. We relocate them," Higgins said. First, the bees go into cardboard boxes with vents that are taped shut. Then they're donated to beekeepers so they can replenish their hives as bees die off, according to Higgins. The detective, who has been on the bee beat for 2 years, said he and his father also privately keep more than 50,000 bees in Hastings-on-Hudson, a village in Westchester County north of the city. The honey goes to family and friends. "It's a gentler task than Higgins' day job, manning the high-tech surveillance system that helps the department keep watch over key parts of the city. The police department's role in removing bees isn't without controversy." Michael Hegedus, president of the Brooklyn Beekeepers Club, said he prefers the city left the job of fetching the bees to private collectors who could harvest the swarms to supplement their own hives. "A package of 10,000 bees is worth up to $120. That's money hanging off a tree that could go to beekeepers who barely cover their costs," Hegedus said. In normal situations, people would tell people to call their local beekeeper and everybody would get a little piece of the action, he said. Scientists consider the insects a biological treasure, warning that their diminishing worldwide population could eventually spell disaster for humans. Bees are essential for pollinating crops that sustain humans. In the United States, commercial beekeepers lost 44% of their honeybee colonies from April 2015 to April 2016, according to the Bee Inform Partnership, a Maryland-based research group. This is Debbie, wishing you a good day.